If you would open your Bibles up to Acts chapter 2, kind of maybe an unusual place to start for our study in Revelation, but turn to Acts chapter 2. We're going to read a passage here real quickly. Before we go into Revelation, I told Tyler this morning that I think these two chapters are the tough ones, or this lesson, this morning's lesson and Wednesday's lesson are the really tough part of the book of Revelation. After this, it's all downhill. But we're going to cover a lot of chapters, both today and Wednesday. And then next Sunday, we're going to have a review. So you're probably going to have a lot of questions. Save up all those questions. Well, actually, I'll take all the questions you have on Sunday next week. But what I want to do is kind of cover the scope of what John is seeing in several of these chapters altogether, so you can see how all these things interrelate to each other and kind of see the big picture of how this is unfolding. If we get into the details and we do these things chapter by chapter, I think you'll forget, 2 weeks from now where we were at 2 weeks before, and we'll see how it all kind of fits together. It's kind of interesting how John has this all laid out in front of him, this vision. But I want to start with something that's a little more familiar to us, but just to remind us about how this apocalyptic literature is used in the Bible. Open up to Acts chapter 2, and I'm going to start reading in verse 16. Acts chapter 2, Peter preaching on the day of Pentecost. Peter gets up, and in verse 16 he says, "But this is what was uttered through the prophet Joel. And in the last days it shall be, God declares, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. And your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even on my male servants and female servants, in those days I will pour out my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will show wonders in the heavens above, and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the day of the Lord comes, that great and magnificent day. And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know." And then Peter goes on with that sermon on the day of Pentecost. And what I want to remind us of here is that this is a passage, when you look at verses 19 and 20, you see a lot of the same kind of language that we're going to be encountering in the book of Revelation. He talks here about the wonders in heavens, the signs on earth, blood, fire, vapor, and smoke, the sun turned to darkness, the moon turned to blood. This is language that Peter was using, and he's using that along with the pouring out of the Spirit to let the people know that God is doing something magnificent on that day of Pentecost, when Peter was standing up and preaching to the people. And I hope we all understand that God didn't fizzle out on the day of Pentecost. He uses this language, and it's very vivid language and powerful language, because God, in fact, did something magnificent on the day of Pentecost, when the gospel first was preached in the world. And that was a great power that God put into the world on that day. We see Romans chapter 1 and verse 16. The gospel is the power of God to salvation. It was something amazing that happened on that day of Pentecost. And the reason I bring that to our attention is, as we go through the book of Revelation and we see the language that describes what is going to come to pass, and again, we'll see this language about fire and vapor and smoke, and we'll see darkness, and we'll see heavenly bodies turn to blood. That doesn't mean necessarily that those things have a physical fulfillment. In fact, I think from the language we see in the Old Testament where these things occurred, it's simply showing that God is intervening in a very powerful way in the world. And God is at work in the world, and he's working wonders. And in many cases, I think, like in the book of Acts chapter 2, a lot of these things that God did, he was using his power on a spiritual plane. And he was achieving spiritual victories. instead of physical victories. And so a lot of times we look at the things of the book of Revelation, and I think we're looking for some kind of physical or political change in the world. And I think in a lot of cases, God was making spiritual changes. And that the changes, they might appear very subtle to us, but the end result was just as dramatic as if God had actually sent a nation out against another nation to conquer them, or God had caused plagues like he caused upon the land of Egypt. God brought plagues upon Egypt that were actual physical plagues, but God can make great changes without introducing physical plagues. You know, the psalmist says that God turns the heart of the ruler just like turning waters. You know, it's something that we can divert water. Those of you who've ever done any farming, you know, you see that, or you even go hiking around here, you can see the old farmers' channels. And they just turn the water any way they want to. And that's what God can do. He can turn the hearts of rulers even in that same fashion. So at this time, go on back to Revelation. We're going to look at chapter 6. As I said before, we're going to move through a lot of things at once. We're again going to see very vivid scenes described to us as we go through this. And John wants us to see what he saw, hear what he heard, feel what he felt. So Revelation chapter 6 says, "Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals. And I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse. And its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him. And he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, 'Come.' And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that men should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine.' When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and by wild beast of the earth." And so here we see the first four seals open. And what are these seals on? They're on a scroll. There's a scroll, and it's been sealed. It's got these wax seals, we might think of, on it. And who is opening the seals? The Lamb is opening the seals. Jesus is opening the seals. He's the only one who is qualified to open the seals on this, on these scrolls. And so he's opening up the scroll as he's opening these seals that are there. Now, as he's opening the seals, John, there are different beings that come to John that are going to show him something. And who is it who comes to John when each of these first four seals is opened?
Living creatures.
One of the living creatures. How many living creatures did we read about in chapter 4? Four creatures, four living creatures. And when the first seal is opened, who comes to John? The first creature, right? And when the second seal is opened, the second living creature comes to him. Now, these living creatures, they were covered with something back in chapter 4. What were these living creatures covered with? Allison?
Eyes.
They've got eyes all over them, these living creatures do. Now, as you go through the book of Revelation, you see here in chapter 6, we're going to read about altogether, seven seals. And we've got seven seals. And then we're going to go and we're going to talk about seven trumpets. And then later on in the book of Revelation, we're going to talk about seven bowls. And these bowls are going to be poured out on the earth as we read through this. Now, you think about opening seals and then blowing trumpets and then pouring out bowls. Do you see a progression in those actions when you think about that? Is there anything that you would you might conclude about opening seals versus blowing trumpets versus pouring out bowls of plagues. Yes, Rich?
So it seems like the seals are like preparing what's going to happen, mm-hmm. right? Like nothing is happening yet. Mm-hmm. The destruction hasn't actually happened, right? It's right. just the authority to take peace from the earth and things like that. Whereas mm-hmm. when the trumpets are blown, that sound moving, that's things are happening. When the bowls are poured out, things are happening, as opposed to just opening, unlocking.
Mm-hmm. So the way that I tend to look at chapter 6, and everybody doesn't look at it this way, a lot of people look at it that there's judgments going on here in chapter 6 as these seals are being opened. But I think a lot of what we see in chapter 6 with the seals being opened is that God is watching. Heaven is watching. You've got these creatures and they're covered with eyes. And God is watching what's happening on the earth. And that's kind of why these creatures are involved with all their eyes. And what are these first four horses, a lot of times, what do people refer to them as? Four horsemen of the apocalypse. They're not actually called that in the book of Revelation, but they are the four horsemen in this New Testament book of Apocalypse. And we see these four horses, and heaven is watching what is happening on the earth. And it's going to progress from that, and we're going to see exactly why it progresses from that. God is going to react to what he sees, and he's going to have trumpets sounded. And the trumpets are going to warn people. They're not a complete judgment. Part of the earth is affected by what happens when the trumpets are blown. And it's a warning that goes out into all the earth. And then later on, as we get further into the book, we'll see the bowls actually poured out. And those are the bowls of God's wrath. That's the bowls of the judgment being poured out on the earth. So we're progressing from God's watching and observing to God warning based on how he's reacting to what he sees. And finally to his executing judgment on the earth as we go through this account. As we look at the first horse, it's a white horse. The rider has a bow. There's a couple of ways that this is commonly interpreted. One way is that the rider is Jesus. And this is the gospel going out into the world. That may be what he's talking about here. One thing, though, that's interesting as we go through, the book of Revelation, is that as you look at the language that's used in verse 2, it says, "And its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him." And as you go through the book of Revelation, when something is given to somebody, or as it says with the red horse, in verse 4, it was permitted to take peace from the earth. Usually that is associated with characters in the book of Revelation that are not the good guys. It's usually the bad guys that are given permission or authority to do something. And that reminds me of the book of Job, where Satan goes to God at the beginning of the book. And God says, "Have you seen my servant Job?" And Satan says, "Well, if he loses all the things you've given him, he'll turn around, he'll curse your name." And God gives Satan permission to do certain things to Job, but he also restricts what Satan is allowed to do to Job. And as we go down and we read about these writers, we'll see that they are given certain things. And just based on what we see throughout the rest of the book, when we read about the beasts that are given certain things, when we read about Babylon, which is given certain things, usually those aren't the good guys in the book of Revelation. That's usually the opposition to God's people that are given things. So the other way that this is often interpreted is it's just talking about wars, because that's what's going on in the world. And so we see war with the first horse. We see bloodshed with the second horse. With the third horse, we see poverty and famine coming into the world. And with the fourth horse, we see death. And it's a bleak picture, what's happening on the world. We talk about, the world is broken. Ed Sanderson, his Facebook page, he often makes that comment. And we see evidence of that every day, the troubles and the trials that are occurring throughout the world. And God looks down at the world and he sees that. But then what we see in particular as we go on, let's look at verse 9. And it's verse 9 when God really starts to react. Verse 9 says, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the witness they had borne. They cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete who were killed as they themselves have been. And so this is something different than God has seen with the first four seals. When the first four seals were open, where was God looking? Where's his attention with those first four seals?
On the earth.
On the earth. When the fifth seal is open, where does God's attention shift to?
Those in heaven.
Those in heaven. Those who have been martyred. He's looking now at the souls of those who have been slain. And why were these people killed? Why does it say that this had happened to them? Because they had done what?
Born witness.
They had borne witness. They had lived the kind of life that the gospel required of them. And because of the life they lived, they bore witness to the earth of what the will of God was. And they were persecuted because of that. Rich?
I think the end of verse 8 had to really flow nicely into 9 for mm-hmm. them, because it ends with they're given the authority to kill by wild beasts of the mm-hmm. earth. And a lot of these Christians were killed by wild beasts.
Right.
The Roman government put them in an arena with a lion, and mm-hmm. it was hungry. And then it goes right into these people who bore witness and were killed for their faith.
And right. That
seems to be a pretty clear connection.
Right. And so they're under the altar. They're there in the presence of God. They've been slain for the word of God and for the witness they bore. And what are they asking for?
Justice.
Justice. They're asking for vindication. God, we have died for you. They're asking, God, how long are you going to wait before you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And how are they responded to? How does God answer them? Yes, Grant?
He acknowledges their faithfulness by giving them a white robe, but then tells them to be patient.
Okay, be patient. And what do they need to wait for?
The rest of the brothers to die.
Yeah, that's... We get impatient perhaps with God sometimes when he doesn't immediately answer our prayers. These are people who have died for God, and they are crying to God for something, and even they have to wait a while. And it's kind of shocking what they have to wait for. There are more Christians who are going to die. God is going to act, but he's not going to act yet. There are still some more of God's people who are going to be killed before the justice does come. But God assures them that the justice will eventually come. Rich?
I think it's interesting that, one, it's rest a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say just rest.
Right.
And then secondly, it says they're to be killed as they themselves have been.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this isn't some other way of people dying. It's people who are going to die for bearing witness to God and
right.
or for God. And so that makes me think that it is a continuing persecution that mm-hmm. they're already experiencing, that they're
right.
being told to wait for.
Right. One of the interpretations of this is that some people believe there were two great waves of persecution, one under Nero and one under Domitian. And the first one is kind of, crested under Nero at this point in its past, but there's another wave that's coming, is the way that sometimes that's interpreted. So here we see that the fifth seal is opened, and then with the next seal, in verse 12, it says, when he opened the sixth seal, I looked, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth, the full moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth, as a fig tree sheds its winter fruit when shaken by a gale. The sky vanished like a scroll that is being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. The kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone slave and free hid themselves in caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? And so we see the first four seals opened, and we see God watching. The fifth seal is opened. We see the cry of the martyrs for justice. And then with the sixth seal being opened, we see God reacting. And we see the earth understanding that God is reacting to what he has seen with the persecution of his people. And what is the reaction of people on the earth? Run and hide. They're ready to run and hide. And we see again in these verses that kind of language that we read back in Acts chapter 2, where we see the heavenly bodies, things upon the earth. We see these things reacting, and they're reacting because God the Creator is angry. And creation is reflecting God's anger, the anger of its creator. That's reflected throughout the earth. God is going to do something. God is going to act. Any questions on chapter 6? We're going to try to move through these, get an overview real quickly through several chapters. Yes, Jack?
Not a question, but just a comment on that last part. It's interesting how man can overlook creation, but if creation is disturbed, it's super apparent and it terrifies them.
Right.
And obviously we haven't witnessed that, but even the smaller things like tidal waves and earthquakes and eclipses, it seems the whole world is enthralled. And of course we read that the creation is evidence that God exists, but it's easily ignored. But once that's disturbed, and these things that you just read, I mean, beyond anything that we can comprehend. The sky falling and all that. But
right.
They serve as a witness even if people don't believe in it. It's just this static thing right now, and God will move it when he wants to.
Exactly. Okay. In verse 16, who is it that's angry? The Lamb. It's the Lamb that's angry. You know, that may be something that surprises us a little bit. So as we go then into chapter 7, we see that the anger of God has been revealed. And then in chapter 7, we've got one of these interludes. You know, it's almost like a play by Shakespeare. When he'll show a scene and then he kind of breaks and he's got this little interlude in there before he goes back into the rest of his play. And Revelation chapter 7, verse 1, after this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, that no wind might blow on the earth or sea or against any tree. And so, you know, I picture these angels, and it's like they've got a hold of the wind. God's ready to just turn the wind on the earth, and he's ready to upset everything, but it's not time yet, so there's these four angels that are just holding it back. They're holding back the destruction. And verse 2 says, and I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun with the seal of the living God. And he called out with a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the earth and sea, saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. 12,000 from the tribe of Judah were sealed, 12,000 from the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 from the tribe of Gad, 12,000 from the tribe of Asher, 12,000 from the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000 from the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000 from the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 from the tribe of Levi, 12,000 from the tribe of Issachar, 12,000 from the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000 from the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 from the tribe of Benjamin were sealed. And so, why were the angels holding back the winds?
To allow these to be sealed.
To allow these to be sealed. And why were they being sealed? We seal stuff today for the same reason. Maybe not exactly the same way.
To protect them from the wrath of the wind.
For protection. Things are sealed for protection in a lot of cases. And that's what God is doing here. The wrath of the Lamb is going to come upon the earth. God's judgment's going to come upon the earth. But God doesn't want to harm his people. And so his people are going to be sealed for their protection. That's the reason why they're going to be sealed. And so then we see described here 144,000 who are being sealed. Rich?
So, if that's another 144,000 besides the ones that are already martyred, I guess that makes sense. But if the servant's number is to be completed, and mm-hmm. then all of a sudden he's talking about a number, mm-hmm. is it possible that the sealing of these faithful witnesses is their death? That in fact, that number is filled up, and they are sealed when they're fully protected. They're not going to sin once they've been martyred. And I'm wondering, I don't remember reading through this before, if mm-hmm. there's anything like the plagues in Egypt where the children of Israel weren't harmed, right? I mean,
right.
That would support the reading that mm-hmm. you were taking. But I'm wondering if maybe sealing them means they've been killed and now they are filled up.
I think there's some language after this in the chapter that might shed a little bit of light on that. And that's a possibility. And there's at least one commentator that I saw who has that view, that it is talking about there's going to be 144,000, or it's represented, the 144,000 is representing this next group of martyrs. Not that there's a literal 144,000 martyrs, but it's representing the next group of martyrs. One of the responses to that was, in the book of Revelation, there's not more than one class of Christians, that every Christian is expected to be all in. And whether you actually died as a martyr or not, you were ready to die as a martyr, was the expectation in the book of Revelation. It's not that there was a lower standard that was going to be acceptable for anybody who was serving Christ. And so you were kind of all in, and for that reason they would tend to think that this isn't referring exclusively to those who are martyred. Roy? Right. And when it talks about the sealing, it seems to be that the sealing here, you know, just based on where the angels, as you said, are holding back the winds, the sealing is on the earth. He's sealing his servants on the earth, seems to be the thought. When we go to verse 9, we see a multitude in heaven. And there's a bit of a contrast there between the 144,000 and the multitude. And so just before we leave the 144,000, we're going to see the 144,000 come up again in the book of Revelation. We're going to read a lot more details about them then and learn a little bit more about this 144,000. But at this point, the 144,000 is made up of 12 groups. Of 12,000 each. And what do each of those groups correspond to?
12 tribes of Israel.
Okay, 12 tribes of Israel. There's few things there, like Dan isn't listed. We see Joseph and Manasseh listed, although Joseph kind of stands for Ephraim a lot of times, and a few things like that. But it's the 12 tribes of Israel that we're seeing there, which were God's people under the Old Testament. And the book of Revelation is a book that uses a lot of Old Testament allusions, as Tyler pointed out in Wednesday night's class. And I think this is one of those allusions. This is God's people that it's talking about, and they're being sealed on the earth. But then verse 9 says, after this I looked, and this is one of the few instances where we see kind of a time reference in the book of Revelation. I don't think the book of Revelation, everything in here occurs in chronological order. But here's something that I think it is pointing out to us does. After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne, among the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, "Who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?" I said to him, "Sir, you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones coming out of great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to the springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes." And so at the beginning, we see the 144,000, and they're sealed on the earth. But now we see this great multitude. And this great multitude, where are they located?
Heaven.
In heaven. How do we know that? They're before what in verse 15? They're before the throne of God. So they're there in heaven. So he sees 144,000 sealed. But after this, there's going to be this great multitude that's before the throne of God. And these people who are before the throne of God, they have come out of what in verse 14? Great tribulation. And so, again, there's a couple ways people look at this, but one way of looking at this is a before and after picture that we're seeing here. The before picture is they're on the earth. There's trouble coming upon the earth. They are sealed to God for their protection. And then in the after picture, they've come through the tribulation, and there's this great multitude that's there before the throne of God. The other way that people look at this is it's not exactly the same two groups, but it's the 144,000 is the group that was going to suffer the persecution at that time, and then they come and they join this larger group. And that to me seems a little more consistent with the way that the text reads, that it's not the same group of people in both cases. But there's this group of 144,000 that's going to come to be part of an even larger group of faithful people. But all these faithful people come through tribulation. They may not come through the same tribulation or the same trials. But, you know, since the beginning of the world, people who've been faithful, they've had trials in their life. They've come through some kind of testing of their faith. And they're brought through this, and they're brought into the presence of God. Where's this multitude from? What's the composition of this multitude? Every nation, every tribe, every people, every language. Heaven's going to be a multicultural place, you know, as we think about it in our terms, in our society. And that's just going to glorify God even more. There are going to be people from every nation, every race, every tongue. They're all going to be there. They're all going to be praising God. They're clothed in white robes. What do they have in their hands?
Palm branches.
Palm And we see the palm branches with the Feast of Booths, when you used to go out with the Old Testament and you would camp to remember how they camped in the wilderness, and they had fellowship with God at that time. And of course, they cast the palm branches down before Jesus on what we refer to today as Palm Sunday, when he triumphantly entered the city of Jerusalem at that time. And they're there. They've come out of great tribulation. How does the elder say they got these white robes? Blood of the Lamb. They washed them in the blood of the Lamb. And that's just, it's such a striking picture. You're taking these robes and you're washing them in this red fluid, and they come out snow white. And that's where they got the whiteness of the robes that they had. And so they're there before the throne of God. They serve him day and night in his temple. They're sheltered by God who sits on the throne. They shall hunger no more. They won't thirst anymore. The sun won't strike them, nor any scorching heat. The Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd. And he will guide them. So Jesus is there. He's guiding his people. He's their shepherd. He's going to lead them to springs of living water. And God's going to wipe away every tear from their eyes. And it's a beautiful picture there as we see things described here in the book of Revelation. One way that people look, I saw this idea of God wiping away every tear. Some of the commentators said that there's a connotation of the way that word tears used there, and I don't know if this is true or not, I never heard this before, but they said a lot of times that word was used when it was talking about tears of joy. A lot of times we think God's going to wipe away every tear because of the suffering we have in this life. But one way it's interpreted is people are going to be so happy when they get to heaven, they're going to be crying and weeping for joy. And God's going to just brush those tears away, like you would brush away the tears of a child who's just so happy. Chris?
And what a great stark contrast from how God is described, the thunder and lightning and everything, and, all that power, and then it comes to this and he's going to wipe away the tears. And whatever it is, whether it's pain or over, joy, it's just what an amazing stark contrast.
Right. So let's go on and let's look a little bit here into the next chapter, because I know Tyler's got a lot to cover on Wednesday, so we're going to try and help him out a bit. But we see then in chapter 8, verse 1, the Lamb opens the seventh seal. Okay, so finally we've got the seventh seal being opened. It says there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. So we've got this dramatic pause that happens. And then in verse 2, then I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel. Then the angel took the censer and filled it with fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. And so we see here the trumpets are given to the angels, but they don't sound them yet. There's an angel that goes to the altar. He's got his golden censer, and there's more and more smoke that's coming out. And it's incense, but it's the prayers of the saints. And so finally God is acting. And he's acting in response to the prayers of the saints. It's the prayers of the saints that cause these seven trumpets to be blown. That's what's prompting God to act. In verse 6 it says, now the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, and these were thrown upon the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. The second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died. And a third of the ships were destroyed. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many people died from the water because it had been made bitter. The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of their light might be darkened, and a third of the day might be kept from shining, and likewise a third of the night. And so we see these first four trumpets being blown, and it's kind of like what we saw with the first four seals. You know, when they opened the seven seals, you had four horsemen, and then you had three other things that followed. And here, again, we see with the first four trumpets, we've got four things taking place on the earth. And people are affected by these things, but people aren't directly affected by what's happening with these first four trumpets that are blown. There are things that are happening to the earth, things that are happening to creation. And as a result of what happens to creation, people suffer as a result of that. That God is making things happen in the natural world. And then in verse 13, he says, "Then I looked and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, 'Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth at the blast of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow.'" And so people are already starting to suffer from the things that are happening with these first four trumpets. They're warnings to people that they need to repent. But now the eagle is saying it's going to get even worse. There's three more trumpets to come, and it's going to get harder for people. And with these next three trumpets, we're going to see people directly affected by what happens as a result of these trumpets being blown. And so we're pretty much out of time, so Tyler's going to pick up there. As I said, next Sunday, we're going to have a bit of a review, but mostly that's kind of answer questions on these chapters. If Tyler doesn't get quite through everything, we're going to have a little bit of cushion so he can cover what's left over on Sunday. Thank you.